to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Tonight, our annual visit from City Manager Troy Schulte. And he's going to give us sort of a state of the city presentation tonight. He's got an impressive background in economics, and he's going to discuss economic issues as well as basically city government issues. So we'll follow our general format tonight. You'll hear from Mr. Schulte, then we will take a break, and then there will be a great many questions from the audience. So before we start, we should tell you that this show is recorded on Sunday, December the 6th of 2015 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. And without further ado, let's go to the introduction of Kansas City City Manager Troy Schulte.
I'm Bill Mullins, a member of the Forum Committee. As most of you know, the Forum is the longest running Kansas City point of conversation and discussion on issues of moral and ethical significance to us all. Today we're honored to have Kansas City City Manager Troy Schulte, who's going to keep us up to date on all the things that are going through his head at this interesting time in the life of Kansas City. Just as a reminder, in Kansas City, Missouri, we have a form of government in which the city manager functions as the chief executive of the conduct of the city's business, and the mayor and the city council serve the equivalent of being the chairman of the board and the board of for the city. However, as we know, the difference between a for-profit company and a somewhat messier civil enterprise is such that there's a lot of politics that gets involved in that. So I think we're always happy to have Troy come and talk about the state of the art in that. And with that, I will turn it over to him. I will mention he had originally anticipated he would be able to stay after. That will not be the case for family personal reasons. So get all your questions in early. Troy?
Bill, thank you very much. My personal reason is sitting down here in the corner. He's got a soccer game in Independence at 11:30. So my wife texted me, says you need to get into Independence. I said, okay, I'm going to Independence then. So it's a pleasure to come down here every year and just kind of give you an update on all the good things that are going on in the city. What I thought I'd talk about today is just to have a conversation with you about something that Bill is one of our partners in, is really just trying to engage the community in a conversation about when we talk about Kansas City as a smart city, and you probably have seen some of the press release announcements, what exactly that means, what we're trying to accomplish, what we hope to accomplish going forward. And so what I thought I'd do is just spend a little time kind of from a city perspective, what do we mean by smart cities, and what do we want to try to accomplish as we move forward. The conversation about smart cities is really just a way to, how does a city of 470,000 people, 318 square miles, with a vast network of traditional infrastructure, use and optimize technology, 21st century technology, to provide services that our residents want. And that's where I think we're changing the nature of what local government is. And I think we're on the dawn of something that is going to be radically different than what has happened in the past. Yes, there will always be water lines. Yes, there will always be fire protection. There will always be sewer protection. There will always be roads, those types of issues. But how they're utilized and the influence and the importance of technology in the use of that is one of the things that I think we're wrestling with as a city. And the reason we're doing that is for folks like Quinn, who is 9 years old, has a multitude, when he's not in trouble, a multitude of electronic devices, whether it be an iPad, an iPhone, those types of issues, and that's how he communicates. And that's how that generation and the generation, the millennials and younger, are communicating. It is a surreal situation to see two teenagers sitting by one another, texting to one another, as opposed to just using the verbal communication. So that's how the world is changing. I read an interesting article where young folks are rapidly choosing electronic devices, that handheld smartphone, versus driving their own vehicles. I couldn't wait when I turned 16. Where I grew up, you could get a learner's permit when you were 14. I had my dad at the DMV on my 14th birthday wanting to get that learner's permit. I have a 14-year-old who does not care in the least about a car. As long as she's got mom and dad to drive around, she don't care. But I think that's the perspective that they're seeing. And I think we as a city have got to be approaching this kind of new horizon in a different manner. And it got us thinking, this whole conversation really started a couple of years ago when we were awarded first in the nation status for Google Fiber. That high-speed fiber, gigabit fiber, that they chose the two Kansas cities to start their process. And what that did was kind of open our eyes to say, you know, maybe the city's role is moving from a non-traditional, moving from a traditional role of providing the basic public infrastructure and letting the free market take place, to having a much more activist role in utilizing technology, both to extend resources, to maximize resources, and then basically bring what I would call shareholder value back to the residents. And I'll give you a couple examples as we move forward that have evolved over this conversation. So the conversation at the civic level started really with Google Fiber. It became to say, you know, here's an interesting way. We were starting to get a lot of young folks coming in that had just heard about Kansas City because they had gigabit fiber access and wanted to come in and set up shop. And then they began to demand all these other services. We saw an influx of millennials wanting those type of non-traditional services being provided by the service, such as digital connectivity, communication via social media. I was chatting with Bill, you know, a couple years ago, we really didn't have much of a social media presence. Now the city of Kansas City is very active in social media because that's one of the mechanisms that we have to communicate with a large number of our residents and visitors is through social media. So what Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of those issues, not beyond just having a web page and those types of issues that were what were the thing to have 3 or 4 years ago, was you got to have an up-to-date web page. Now, it's really what's your position, what's your status, how are you using social media to engage folks in the communication of the work of the city and the input that we need from the city. So that conversation started really, as I mentioned, with Google Fiber, and it's come forward a couple years ago when we started construction of the streetcar line, which is wrapping up construction now. We should get our next streetcar, I believe, Tuesday. So that'll bring two of the four that are coming in. The first one is going through testing. But one of the conversations we engaged with was Cisco Networks, who does a lot of the back office communication systems, was interested in working with us to create basically a smart city approach where we would use the latest technology along that streetcar line from the River Market, City Market area to Union Station as a way to change how cities are perceived as providing services. So we said, sure, we're game for it. They were going to leverage the private sector to bring investment dollars to the table. We were going to provide some money for public infrastructure components of it, but they were going to leverage the private sector. So one of the issues that has come out of that is we are trying to create, and I can tell you it's easier said than done, a first seamless wireless network along the streetcar line that, as if you're on your wireless network standing at a streetcar stop, you can walk into a streetcar, get on the streetcar line, and never have a disruption in service. And then you can step off at another point in town and never lose connectivity for even the briefest instant. Now, again, sounds great, easier said than done, apparently. So that has caused our partners at Sprint a great deal of trouble, but they want to try to roll this concept out using our streetcars line, that it becomes a very seamless method of communication. So as we looked at that, we started to look at, all right, are there other opportunities for us? We partnered with a company called Rhythm Engineering. They're based out of Leawood, Kansas. They're going to eventually move to the Crossroads. and we have created a smart traffic signal system that is being installed along that corridor and will really be the future of how we provide traffic management, traffic flow, using about 450 signals. This will affect about 12 to 15 when we're done. But basically what it is, it's a smart system that learns as it and observes and makes changes in real time. So the classic example is, if I'm late at a classic example, if you've ever been downtown at 9:30 in the evening or 10 o'clock in the evening, you may pull up to an intersection and find you're the only one there and you're sitting at a red light. And you will sit there until the light completes its normal cycle as it would if it was 7:50 in the morning. What this technology does is simply, through the use of cameras and sensors, say, oh, I've got a car here, I've got cars, I have no cars from any of the three directions, why don't we give that particular individual a green light? And so what it does is real-time capability of being able to adjust and say, here are the traffic demands along that. The other thing that's going to be an interesting twist is it also has pedestrian sensing capabilities. So the other thing it will do is if it sees a pedestrian on the street, it will trigger the walk signal for that and start that process rather than the old days of having to go out and find the beg button to turn the pedestrian crosswalk. Those days are over. So, and the advantage of that is you're using one piece of technology. You used to always have to have multiple pieces of technology around here, so you're simplifying it. It'll reduce the overall cost to the city, but you're using that one camera to not only sense a car, but it will sense a pedestrian, and it will learn and adjust on the fly. So this capability has the ability to say, after a while, this traffic signal will learn that at a particular time of day, there is more traffic at this intersection and will adjust accordingly versus another time of day, say on a Tuesday, when there's a different traffic flow, and will make those adjustments as it goes forward. So it learns. And that's one of the interesting things as we look forward to, are there opportunities for us to use technology in a different way to make it more seamless in the delivery of city services. So you're going to see along that streetcar route, as I mentioned, you're going to see the smart signals. You're also going to see a whole lot of sensors along that, which are essentially cameras that will do a multitude of abilities. They'll be able to say, I have a parking spot that's available, and I can send you to a mobile app to tell you there is a parking spot that's free at such and such a time. That mobile app will then be able to automatically charge your credit card or debit card for the parking. So the concept of meters are probably a thing of the traditional parking meters will probably be a thing of the past. Going forward, as all of this becomes automated, becomes electronic, they will be able to sense if someone is parked over the white line and dispatch a tow truck or a police officer the ticket and remove the vehicle to keep the streetcar from having to stop for folks. So all of those issues are going to be rolled out in the next year. And again, it's a different way of looking at how the city has traditionally provided services. The other thing that we're going to be putting in is smart lighting. And you probably have seen that if you watch the morning news show, the Sunday morning news shows, about the lights that will, the LED lights that will automatically brighten or dim depending on whether there is pedestrians. We will have that capability. It will all be able to be controlled remotely. So my traffic engineer or my street light engineer can get an alarm and say, my street light, I've got a problem with a street light at such and such, it will send an alarm automatically. We won't have to wait for someone to call our 311 call center or one of our contractors or some city employee to notice we've got a street light issue. It will automatically send us a notification, allow our contractor to dispatch accordingly. Those are the types of things we're going to roll out in this first 2.2 mile system, but then we're going to try to expand it citywide. So when you think about street lights that automatically dim or adjust based on pedestrian activity, and you then apply that from a corridor that of probably several hundred streetlights citywide with 90,000 streetlights, you start to see the financial implications of that. One of the things that we did as testing is these new LED lights can run on about 75% power and be just as bright as the hydrogen sulfide lights that are currently, the kind of the yellow lights that we see all over the city. For 75%, they run just the brightness is about the equivalent to. They have a longer maintenance span, and they're much more efficient from a utility cost. When you extrapolate that we spend $5.5 million a year on just paying the power bill on 90,000 streetlights, and if you can run 90,000 streetlights at 75% power, and they will automatically adjust if they sense pedestrian activity, your savings then to the city as a whole is $1.5 million, $2 million, which can then be spent on other things as we move forward. So those are the types of things when we look at a smart city approach, and folks like Bill are helping us kind of imagine the possibilities. And that's what is kind of exciting, is we don't necessarily know what the future holds, but we think we have to put a framework in place, build the infrastructure in place, to be able to adapt and respond to new technology, to make sure that that we have the ability to communicate. So one of the issues that we're working with is mobile wireless companies, Sprint, AT&T, Verizon, have issues, and you've noticed it around town, where there will be pockets of what they call dead zones, where the signal doesn't work. Well, rather than putting up these large towers that cause issues with zoning issues, cause neighborhood issues, these large cell towers, which are very expensive and have some quality of life issues, they have adapted it so that they basically can put a little bulb on the top of a streetlight pole. And so they can now communicate through a series of those. And we have worked out a partnership with a company for every one that they have put in that will benefit our residents at no cost. They will give us 10 of those smart LED lights at no cost. So, again, we're able to leverage them. We generate the financial savings, the maintenance savings. They get better service for their customers, and the city as a whole benefits from a connectivity standpoint. So those are the types of partnerships you look at in a smart city conversation. The other thing we've got is a great opportunity right now as we rebuild a lot of our water and sewer infrastructure. We're in year 5 of the 25-year overhaul of our sewer system. We just, as part of the streetcar project, took out, I may have told you this or mentioned this in other forums, we took out a water line, a wooden water line at Independence in Delaware that dates from the 1840s, when the water was hand pumped up out of the river to service the River Market area. It was basically an old railroad tie that had been bored out in 4 sections, and they pumped water through it, and at some point in the 1850s got incorporated into the city system and had been there ever since. So when people say, I think I got a splinter, but they were right. You could, if you were in the right parts of the city, you could have actually gotten a splinter by drinking a glass of water. So, but that's the kind of issue when you look at an investment of a water line that was put in the 1840s and now just replaced in 2014. That kind of an investment, and how do you reutilize, repurpose, readapt that technology, that basic infrastructure investment for the next century. So we have sewer lines that were replaced that date from the 1850s, the 1860s, hand-dug brick sewer lines that are sometimes 6-7 feet in diameter, 8 feet in diameter, 10 feet in diameter, provide a whole lot of capacity. One of the things we're working with is a company, an engineering company that has partnered with Black & Veatch, a company out of South Bend, Indiana, that basically has now created a smart sewer pipe using a series of sensors that can detect flow, stormwater flow, sanitary sewer flow into these large diameter pipes. And once flow hits a certain level, a sensor will trigger, and it will trigger a series of dams that will expand to use the full capacity of these sewer pipes. So imagine the OK Creek Sewer, which is a, I believe, 12-foot diameter sewer that runs right under Union Station all the way to the Kansas River. It normally runs and creates overflow when it's about 4.5 to 5 foot deep. By using these coffee dams And these sensors and these ability to deploy new technology in this pipe, we can now run that pipe on large storm events at 9 to 10 foot deep. So we've doubled our capacity and didn't have to spend tens of millions of dollars upgrading or replacing that pipe. So the implications to our overflow control program, as we look at building these large-scale tunnels and utilizing our existing infrastructure, could translate to savings to our residents of several hundred million dollars over the life of these projects if we can better deploy and utilize technology to take advantage of the existing infrastructure as opposed to building all new. Some may call that a green approach. I just say it's a very efficient, very effective use of gray infrastructure. And the best way to be green is to reutilize the existing infrastructure that's there. You may have heard there's been a little bit of controversy about BNIM and their new corporate headquarters in downtown Kansas City as it relates to tax increment financing, but they've approached us and said, as part of our effort to do our building, a 21st century building that meets all environmental standards, we would like to tap into the water and sewer lines as a way to extract heat and energy. So they're working with us to basically put a little fan, a turbine, in one of our water pipes that would flow by their site. That would, as the water rushes through that water pipe, it spins off energy that would allow them to heat and cool or power the electricity in their building. They will pay us for that. And it also gives them a demonstrable, marketable issue. They can go to other cities around the country saying, look what we were able to do in Kansas City. And it potentially provides yet another market, another revenue stream for this infrastructure to be used in a new and different way. So these are all of the concepts that we have that, in my mind, are related to smart cities. And how do we do that, and how do we provide infrastructure in a different way? There's a very young man who has a great idea, and he's working with the Missouri Department of Transportation, owns a company called Integrated Pavement. Some of you may have heard that, where it is basically, instead of having to take out a section of pavement when you repair a section of highway, instead of having to jackhammer it out, truck it away, it is actually comes as a section. And the section can be lifted out and lifted into place. When it breaks, a new section can be dropped into place. The other thing that he has incorporated into that is sensors that will be able to track activity, who's driving, what some of the issues are. One of the things we use this as an example, and in Kansas City there's lots of conversations, lots of drama, lots of consternation about billboards. You're probably, in many respects, a billboard may be in 25 years the equivalent of a buggy whip. It's just not needed anymore. Because what this gentleman is seeing is that instead of driving down the highway, looking at the billboards as you drive on I-70, as you drive on 71 Highway, or as you drive through Waldo or wherever and you see the billboards, imagine those billboards, the equivalent of those billboards, flashing on your dashboard or flashing on your display monitor in your, and it's targeted and it's tailored based on your purchasing preferences. So you won't see something that's baked that you're not interested in, but if you've got young kids, you may find you get pop-up displays about youth soccer leagues or something like that. Or if you're a dog lover, and you'll find those are the types of issues as opposed to the static display. Imagine, and if you think that if that causes you some issues, imagine how that will work when you're a captive audience with a driverless car. When you no longer have responsibility to drive the car, you're just visually presented. Projections on your screen, projections on those issues, all driven in a different way, coming by as you drive by, it triggers based on your preferences, based on your purchasing preferences, and sends you a menu of information as you look at that. And all that technology is embedded in the pavement as you drive by. That's the world we're looking at. So the city is in a situation where it's got to be able to adapt to that kind of, so that we can continue to attract new investment, new ideas in the city. So how do we build the same infrastructure in a new and different way? And that's what's exciting to me about the Smart City. We have engaged folks like Bill and a number of folks in a Smart City Advisory Council where we're engaging ideas, trying to look around the curve. Day-to-day operations, as you might attest, are to make sure we get that tree that needs to be trimmed. We get that sewer back up. There was a water main break. I noticed I got another water main break or an issue down on the plaza I noticed this morning. You deal with those issues. What we need is the public's help to help us look around the curve. What's coming? And how does the city react and be in a position where it can take advantage of whatever the next big thing is, that the city's able to adapt and react and take advantage of those opportunities, attract new businesses, new capital into the city as we move forward. So one of the issues that we continue to look at, yes, we're building streetcars because there's a generation of folks that are more interested in public transit than the current my generation or maybe the generation above me, and are more interested in finding those ways to communicate. So we have to build public transportation again. We're probably uniquely situated. We have more highway miles per capita than any other city in the country. We're uniquely positioned, I think, to be a leader in driverless technology, driverless car technology, because we've got the highway miles already established. In fact, I mentioned the group with Integrated Payments. They want to do a pilot project with MoDOT. They're looking for between MoDOT and the city to do a section of Bruce R. Watkins, which would have the smart pavement installed, which could then be a guidepost to how I-70 might be reconstructed going forward. Imagine a way that would be generating revenue to help pay for the cost of that construction as opposed to the traditional levying taxes or fuel taxes or some of those types of issues. So we have to look at how we provide services in a different way. And you're starting to see that. The library has already gone ahead with in terms of digital, being able to access software. They're looking at what the traditional library services were, which you went, you showed them a card, and you checked out a book. Now they're doing downloads to your smartphone, the e-books, the software. You can go in and check out and use the software for a period of time under a licensing agreement. There's a number of ways that local governments, all levels of government, are having to react to this changing needs, the changing world that we're living in. So it's an exciting time for the city of Kansas City. We're uniquely positioned because all our infrastructure is old, it's got to be replaced anyway. So what's the right way to do it? How can we do it to get the most bang for our buck as we move forward? Obviously, the benefits to those are new revenue streams and reduced tax burden and a way to use technology. So that's what's exciting, is we're consistently looking for new ideas, innovative approaches where we can use resources, our limited resources. A classic example, is there a different way to use technology in the means of providing law enforcement capability? Every police officer, to equip and train a police officer and pay a salary, is $100,000 a year. And that cost won't go down as time goes forward. But if you can use that one police officer and then equip them with necessary cameras, communication tools, ability to monitor sensors, those types of issues that feed that information to that officer, we have less need for multiple officers. That one officer can accomplish multiple things more efficiently. So those are the types of issues. We put in license plate readers a couple of years ago. You may have remembered that shooter down in the Grandview Triangle who was shooting at cars. That was found by looking at using license plate readers to track movement of cars through the Grandview Triangle, and then by process of elimination, looking at some, they were able to find the person. We are now putting license plate readers on traffic signals as you move through, so that we can use that as a law enforcement mechanism, not to spy on the good folks, but to go after the bad guys, and to use that information for that purpose. So we put in a license plate reader a couple years ago at Independence and Prospect. Within the first day of operation, 2,400 cars had used that intersection. 400 of them had outstanding warrants. It then allows us the tool to go out and begin to narrow those issues down, go after the bad guys, get the folks that are scofflaws, and hold them accountable, which reduces the burden on everybody else. So that's the use of technology in a very positive way. There are concerns about privacy. Those issues, we will work through them collectively, as because this is happening not only in Kansas City, but nationwide. And I think this is going to be the preeminent issue going forward is how do you provide those modern comforts of life, but do it in a way that respects and maintains personal privacy in those issues going forward. So that's going to be the issue that we – and if you would have said 10 years ago to a city manager anywhere in the country, data management and data privacy may be your preeminent issue that you have to work with, you have to study in the next 15 years, you would have been laughed at. But it has evolved so much that – data management, data privacy are issues that touch my desk almost on a daily basis because of the speed and rate and transformation of how information technology is affecting city services. I think positively there are some downside risks, but we have to manage it. So I got the proverbial hook is out. I want to stop and say thank you very much. I always enjoy this chance as a conversation. I'm happy to answer any questions, but it's an exciting time in Kansas City. And while I've got you, I'll quickly mention we have a little election here in April that I'm going to need your support on, and that is the 1% earnings tax is up for renewal in April, first Tuesday in April. Some numbers you need to remind, it generates about $230 million for the city. 50% is paid by residents of people who don't live in this city. It constitutes 40% of the general fund, and that general fund, 75% of that general fund pays for public safety, police, and fire. So it's a critical sales tax. One only need to look across the border to realize what tax structures do in terms of causing upheaval in government. So, yes, there are alternatives. They will not be pain-free. So I can't tell you how to vote, but I can encourage you that you need to vote in April to keep that critical revenue stream flowing for the city, because the alternatives are sales taxes and property taxes, which will affect Kansas City, Missouri residents more so than the current earnings tax. So thank you very much. I'm happy to answer your questions.
Time to take a break. You're listening to the All Souls Forum. That was Kansas City City Manager Troy Schulte basically updating us on what's going on in the city and some upcoming tax issues that the voters will have to think about. Let's do a few messages for you. We'll come right back. We'll have a great many questions from the audience, as you can imagine. You're listening to the All Souls Forum right here on KKFI.
I'm sure it's very difficult to set priorities, and there's a strong feeling that Kansas City should be on the leading edge in technologies, but we still have a fairly substantial population that lives in almost third world conditions. Particularly on the east side. I'm wondering if you can address that in the context of priorities.
Well, obviously we think the economic situation where we will have 40 to 50% unemployment rate in parts of our have African American males in parts of in certain neighborhoods in the city are a critical issue that we have to deal with as we move forward. One of the things that obviously you've seen the mayor stress while he's been in office, and one of the issues that ties into our technology issue, is we have to deal with this digital divide, because as you said, we have a great deal amount of poverty. We have a great deal of folks who are being left behind. And as the world accelerates and changes in the terms and the types of technology they use, we had a few years ago, school kids in the Kansas City public schools were provided laptops as part of their educational system. But when they were taken home, there was no internet connectivity. And so they essentially were not useful, because it only works if those take-home computers, if you can use those in an environment where you have access to the internet. And a large number of our residents do not have. So one of the things that we're trying to do, again, as part of the technology issues, working with the Department of Housing and Urban Development, Google Fiber, Sprint, is creating trying to create mobile wireless portals that can be checked out from a library that can be taken home for digital connectivity. So those folks that have that are assigned a computer, if they're a fifth grader or a sixth grader, would have the ability to check out a mobile card. In fact, there's an entrepreneur who actually is converting old cell phones into these little mobile wireless hotspots that you could check out from the public library, do your homework, study on the internet, check it back into the public library, and be made available for another. Those are the types of things that the city has got to do, because long term, we have got to figure out a way to bridge that digital divide, to bring folks, to connect them so that they've got the same economic development job opportunities that more affluent members of our city have, the routine access. My son does not think anything of being able to jump from wireless device to wireless device depending on the need and location. He's fortunate, but every other kid needs that same capability in the city, because that's where the world's going to be in 20, 25 years. That's going to be that ability to code, use information in that way is going to be what's going to allow job creation as we go forward. So a city has got to do, again, a different type of dealing with that infrastructure that 25 years ago we weren't worried about. Now we are, and that's why we have to engage in these types of issues going forward. So housing programs, all of those issues that we continue to do have to be augmented by another layer of access to technology, access to training, coding schools, learning new information technology procedures and protocols. All of that has got to become part of the basic educational framework in which we provide not only the reading, writing, and arithmetic. You got to have IT as a component of it as we go forward. So these things are generational in nature. They will take some time. But, yes, that's, I think, the biggest issue is we've got too many have-nots in this city, and how do we connect them and tie them in with the haves? Sir.
Yes. I'd like you to, I hope, unconfirm a rumor that I've heard from numerous people that the city has paid the family of a person that was shot down near the Power and Light District, and trying to get any information about it is almost impossible. So it's a twofold question. One, did such a payment take place? And how much do we pay out each year on police-related activities?
To my knowledge, and I would usually see that type of stuff, there's been no payment. And there has not been that much issues with large-scale payments that I'm aware of in the police department. There are some routine errors and omissions. Most of our payments related to folks are related to traffic accidents or those types of issues, not to the shooting. I can assure you in Kansas City, seeing evidence in Chicago of a $5 million payment to the family that was done very quietly, you can't do that in Kansas City. That would take a council ordinance or action by the Board of Police Commissioners to do that. So all those settlements have to be approved publicly via the council if they're over $25,000. So I'm not aware of any payment that's been made. There may be discussions with legal folks, but nothing that has reached my say, and anything would have to be publicly disclosed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask on the first I want to say thank you all for keeping people safe during the World Series when you had over 800,000 people. Because my thing is with that is evidently we must have something in place to even tackle terrorism. Some people don't see that here, I think, on a larger scale, and I believe you all must have something great in place that even that day for me, bad back, walking around, you know, I'm a community activist, just in different areas, it just seemed like everybody stayed happy, they weren't worried. I mean, I could tell some of our police were tired, to be honest, I talked to some, they were, but they hung in there through the whole thing. So I'm praying when you just discussed that you have something in place to put, you know, they could check the license plates if they're going. But if it's somebody new that has never done anything, I'm praying we have something in place. And I believe we have since I've seen, I'm serious, say, 100,000.
Yeah, we have been utilizing technology and cameras to keep it. We started a couple years ago by putting mobile cameras up with the St. Patrick's Day Parade and being able to monitor all that in real time at our Emergency Operations Center and be able to do it. We did the same thing with the World Series, with the playoffs, and with the parade. So we have much more of that monitoring, that surveillance capability that we can keep an eye on. The credit goes to the residents of this metropolitan area. That was a fantastic crowd. We had 800,000 people, 3 arrests. We probably could have arrested some more. We just couldn't get to them. But most of the issues, if people got out of hand, who was corralling them? Was the neighbors or the adjoining parties saying, knock it off, we can't, you know. And having that many people in that small of an area has a tendency to force people to kind of behave because they can't move around and cause mayhem. So a lot of that is technology, being aware that we were able to respond if we needed to. A picture that I now have in my office is a police equestrian or horse squad escorting an ambulance out of the parade grounds along Main Street, because we used the horses to kind of push the crowd back so we could get an ambulance. A lady had gone down to the parade and gone into labor up in the crowd at Union Station, so we had to get her out of there. So we had to use the police equestrian unit to push the crowd back. But everybody cooperated, and we have a new baby girl whose, I believe, first name is Royal, as I understood from PD, that was born as a result of that process. So those are the kind of things that make it kind of fun. But again, everybody came together. Yeah. One of the issues that concerns us is that kind of coverage for Kansas City got national and international attention. About, wow, there are 800,000 people. So we have had conversations with folks who say, if Kansas City wasn't on the map before for a potential terrorism incident, it is now. So we have to be cognizant. We have to be always aware of our surroundings. We're going to do what we can. I've got a tremendous police force. I couldn't be prouder of the work that they do in terms of embracing technology, but it's going to take a lot of awareness of people. If you see something, say something, because that's how we're going to get control of it. But it was a fantastic event, and hopefully we don't have to wait another 30 years to do it again.
Okay, and my second question, I'm sorry, is...
thank you. Would you discuss a little bit the downside of the smart city, the things like malware and cybercrime and just busts that foul up the traffic system for a while? I mean, there's some other elements.
Yes, I mean, that's part of the issue is you, along with all of these smart city issues, the ability for people to the hacking and to do damage, those kind of issues. Those are the kind of issues you've got to put in place, is you've got to put in those security protocols, those sense, the protections. The good thing about on the smart traffic signals, as I mentioned, the default provision, if there is something where something goes wrong, it defaults back to the, oh, I'll just wait for the cycle to move around. So the default provision is basically what we have now. So if we are hacked or if there is some sort of intrusion or something like that, we try to put in redundancies that put us in some sort of a default that allows us to function. But that's one of the issues, as we have before, is security issues and how do we manage it and how do we control it. We're always vulnerable to one piece of weak software. A couple years ago, I had a group that works down on the plaza try to hack into the city to get in to see if they could shut the city down. They were able to, over the course of one evening, access a relatively minor piece of software, then break into our financial system, and in a report they pulled up my payroll information on the screen. They had been able, within about 4 hours, to access our personnel system. And then they could say, well, I don't think Mr. Schulte needs to get paid, and they could have wiped me out as a city employee. So those are the types of issues. So we have to be very proactive in using our own kind of tech folks to search out and figure out where our vulnerabilities are. So it's as we move forward. But that's kind of the issue that we're going to have to race with. Again, a different level of services than we were providing nearly a decade ago.
I live at 12th and Washington, and I frequently have to go to 13th and Main to shop. Driving down 12th Street is a real challenge for three reasons. Reason number one, the traffic lights are not synced.
Right.
So each traffic light you get to, you take a pretty good chance on having it red and having to wait through the whole cycle. Issue number two are jaywalkers. People just don't seem to understand that when the light is green, that's the time to cross the intersection. Don't cross in the middle of the block or you take a good chance on getting hit. And issue number three is lane blockages, either by illegal parkers or construction work, which seems to go on forever. So my real question to you is, as a society, how can we educate people to go along with the system that is set up that is supposed to make things flow more efficiently? What kind of educational processes are we lacking that we could implement to accomplish
that? Well, I think that the big issue is the smart traffic signals will solve that. We've got most of our north-south streets are synchronized, but our east-west streets aren't. So that we think this technology will allow us to synchronize our east-west streets. That's issue number one. Second issue, and I think the most to your point, is we have to educate folks that you now have in an urban environment. I always tell the story of 15 years ago, I was a young entry-level analyst at Kansas City, Missouri government. I couldn't make change for a $5 bill at 5:15 in the evening to ride the bus home. And the mayor uses an analogy, a little more colorful analogy, of being able to say, 10 years ago, he could have run naked up Broadway at 12 o'clock at night, and nobody would have known whether he did it or not. Now there are people, it's an active urban environment, and we have got to realize that the ability that you could drive unimpeded through downtown Kansas City without traffic issues, those days are over. So the third issue about always construction, that's going to be part of, again, I think an educational about an urban environment. We're having trouble on the streetcar line with the most egregious abusers of our no parking issues along the white line or on the tracks are UPS vehicles. So we towed two UPS trucks. Those are pretty expensive to get retrieved from the tow lot. Hit to the head to realize that, oh, I've got to do those types of issues. But so we've got a long educational process about what it takes in an urban environment, and it's just going to take a while because we're not used to it, except we probably only had one urban environment area historically in the city, and that's been the Country Club Plaza. Now we have multiple urban environment areas, and we're going to have to learn.
We have time for about two more questions.
I think you've been quoted in the Star as favoring TIF for the BNIM project.
Yes.
And I can assure you everybody in this room understands the need for business development. And I think it's been said more business development will bring more money into the library and other of our services. But frankly, I'm really concerned that TIF is consistently taking money from at least our library system. So tell us, please, how you justify and you rationalize the loss of income to our library system in favor of the TIF projects.
Very easily. I think the city as a whole has got to invest in business development. You may have seen Steve Rose's editorial this morning in the Star. Those types of issues, if the business development doesn't occur in Kansas City, Missouri, and it's going to occur in the Kansas City metropolitan area, others will be providing it as a resource. And that's part of my concern. BNIM is a homegrown company. They're 45 years old. They're a Kansas City company, Kansas City born and raised company. But if we don't retain them, they will be offered incentives to relocate across the state line. Those are 45, eventually 75 high-paying jobs that ought to be in Kansas City, Missouri, paying the earnings tax, providing those issues, providing the financial support to support the libraries, all the ancillary issues. There will be, if you locate BNIM, around BNIM will be other architectural firms that won't receive incentives. That will lift this that will lift all boats. And so I recognize it's a very and everyone says, well, if you just focus your resources on the east of Truce, it would work. I can assure you every resource that is used west of Truce is available east of Truce in a greater magnitude, because we're willing to make those investments. We've got to figure out a way to stimulate demand. 10 years, I'd encourage you, if you haven't been out there, drive by Beacon Hills at 24th and Truce, 24th and Forest. Those are $500,000 speculative homes being built and sold east of Truce Avenue in this city. So it takes a constant effort to rebuild the infrastructure, provide incentives. All of those houses have 10 years of property tax abatement, but in year 11, that's going to be a $500,000 home coming on the tax rolls in an otherwise area that was mostly just vacant land. And that's changing the nature of the conversation. We've got to move forward. So, yes, it's an investment, but the long-term dividend. And I think there needs to be a conversation about TIF in the city, about the length of TIF. I think that's the conversation, but not the tool. The tool is a very valuable tool that just says, for a short period, we're going to redirect the taxes. But I think we have to have a rational conversation about I think the library, and in the particular situation on the library, the pilot that project is paying will make the library they will be net positive on taxes going forward than they are now. So those are the issues that when you look at it from what their tax revenue is right now versus what their tax revenue will be, even with their pilots that the developer will pay, there will be more money to the library short term. Ma'am.
Thank you for thinking away the way you are thinking about the future. In your conversations, however, it seems to me you limit yourself by saying the city this, the city that. Do you, in your conversations, use terms like Greater Kansas City, or the ideas that have been appearing from Helly and some of those people? Do you include that kind of vision in your conversation?
Yes. And I think from a regional standpoint, that's where Kansas City, I think, has to lead the way. Google Fiber went into Kansas City, Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri first, but now is in Overland Park and all of these other cities. I think it's the responsibility of the major city in the region, again, to kind of set the agenda for the metropolitan area. And that's what part of the issue is, whether it's using new technologies. We have a group that we work with called the Core Four, which is Jackson County, Johnson County, Wyandotte County, and Kansas City, Missouri, where we just get together and talk about regional wastewater, regional transit, some of those types of issues. Out of that conversation, Joe Reardon, who now is at the ATA, was an early participant in those conversations about regionalizing our bus system as opposed to having four different bus systems. We're well on our way to having one bus system for one region. It only took us 50 years. But those are the types of conversations that come out of it. But it took folks in Kansas City, I think, spearheading the conversation, saying, this is, we need to do this. We'll trade off a little bit for our benefit, for the benefit of the region. But when I talk about the city, my focus is on dealing with the 318 square miles that people yell at me about, but it's also that broader concept of how do we move the region forward, because other regions who don't have this state line issue are eating our lunch in terms of job development, job creation, use of technology, those types of issues. So we have got to compete, because our competition, Kansas City's competition, is not Overland Park, not Independence, Missouri, not Lee's Summit, Missouri. Our competition is Austin, Texas, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Barcelona, Spain. That's where the job creation, that's where the creative thinking is going in the decades ahead. It's a global economy we have to deal with. So I want as much of that job creation, that creative thinking capacity located in Kansas City, Missouri, selfishly, but then in Kansas City region as a whole going forward. Because if we don't, those jobs will go elsewhere.
You've sort of teed up my question, and I don't need a real long answer, but it goes to the question of the capacity to learn from experience. Those of us have been following this for a while, and really with Google Fiber, continue to ask the question, what are the lessons learned from the experience with Google Fiber that are being factored into the relationship with Cisco and the Smart Cities Initiative? Because there is a concern that the ideas flow much, much faster today than they did back in the days when, if you wanted to build a hotel or change the airport, years of lead time, and people could catch up. Today, we've got these ideas rolling so fast. How are we taking the time, and do we have the staff and the developmental capacity to match our ability to craft aspirations? And I think I know the answer, and so the question would be, how can we help move more in that direction?
Well, yeah, I think it's a different way. It's a different way of engaging our citizenry. As Bill mentioned, we used to have the conversations about these projects were multiple year in process and construction projects and 5-year planning horizons. Google Fiber showed up about 90 days before their announcement.
And hadn't designed
a single thing. They had a concept. Hey, we want to provide high-speed gigabit. It's never actually been tried at that corporate level. There have been, and so that's kind of the issue, is how much, and that's finding that balance of saying we want to be risk-takers, but maintaining a healthy level of risk aversion that we don't get ourselves in over our heads or make a big financial mistake. So there are times I have grumbled about Google Fiber learning how to run a municipal telecommunications industry while tearing up our streets and our sidewalks and our parking areas throughout the city. If I had that $1 million for every complaint I've got for boring through a fence or boring through a driveway, we wouldn't have any budget problems ever, you know. So that's the issue. Is that helped us move the conversation forward, that we're a smart, technically savvy city, but at the same time, at what the city has the right to protect itself from people who may not know what they're doing. I think Google's a tremendous asset, but we've learned, and now they've learned because of they learned how to do what not to do based on what they did in Kansas City. So it's making them effective in Austin, Charlotte, and those types of conversations. We've got to be able to anticipate and use that information, trying to anticipate some of this stuff ahead of time. Easier said than done, but that's that chicken or egg. Do you wait too long and then the whole thing misses you, or do you take a risk of finding what level of risk is the right level of risk?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Look forward to hearing from you again next year.
You've been listening to Troy Schulte, who's the Kansas City City Manager, and been so since 2011. His job is making city government work and run efficiently. And he also serves the City Council and, of course, at the Mayor's pleasure. And we heard kind of a roundup of what's going on and what's coming down the pike for Kansas City. This program was recorded on Sunday, December 6th of 2015 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Wallace Street in Kansas City, Missouri. You can catch this program and other programs in this series on KKFI's podcast page on its website at kkfi.org. Normally it takes a few days for the shows to get up there, so I suspect that you will have this show podcast by early next week. So jump over there when you can, and there's a wonderful selection of other public affairs programs available for your listening pleasure and education. The music you're hearing is composed and performed by Kansas City musician Fred Potter. This program is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. Thank you, as always, to Rita Norton and her staff at the All Souls Church for their help in presenting you this program each week. Tune in again next Wednesday, same time, same place, for the All Souls Forum. You're listening to 90.1 FM.